The Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon on the Big 550 KTRS. It's appropriate we're playing Dirk Commissar to start off the showbiz stuff today, because songs like this and from that era of the 80s make up the soundtrack to the big movie that Max and I are going to review for you today, which is called Atomic Blonde. And it has songs like Voices Carry by Till Tuesday and 99 Luftballons by Nena.
Or 99 Red Balloons, too. There were two versions of that.
Yeah, she released one in English and one in German. The one in the movie is in German because it takes place in Germany. I actually, right after the movie, went to my car and tried to remember some of the other songs that were in there. Cat People by David Bowie. And Major Tom by Peter Schilling.
Whoa!
A one-hit artist, if ever I heard one.
Yeah.
Those were in there. And by the way, the song Der Kommissar, which Ian was just playing, that's the version by After the Fire. There was also a hit version by the group called Falco that also did the same song. And they're both in the movie as well. So I tell you that because, kind of like Baby Driver, this is going to be a big soundtrack seller, don't you think, Max?
I was going to buy the soundtrack before I realized I have all of these songs already. In an early scene, Fight the Power by Public Enemy is blaring, and I thought, hey, I might like this movie. And then later on, they play a song from Ministry, which I don't know if I've heard Ministry in a major motion picture. That was phenomenal. And I thought I should get the soundtrack. I thought, no, I actually have these songs
already. Well, for people who don't have it, I think that the soundtrack, a lot of people are going to be downloading it on Spotify.
It's iTunes, great. It's really great.
And all the rest.
How about Voices Carry by Till Tuesday? That's actually used in the plot of the film as well.
Yes, it is. Lead singer Amy Mann. You're welcome.
Wow,
man.
A-I-M-E-E. So let's talk about what this movie is about. It's based on a graphic novel, and as Max knows, there are two things I normally don't like. One, movies in a dystopian future, and two, movies based on a graphic novel, which used to be called comic strips, comic books.
Is this a true story?
Sort of.
It's based on.
Oh, okay.
Based on a true story. So lay out the plot.
I'm not going to talk about the bias when it comes to the source material of graphic novels, because we could do that for about half an hour. And maybe on some upcoming show we should.
Okay.
But I get people don't like certain things. They don't like Westerns. They don't like anime. They don't like comic books. Totally get that.
And by the way, my bias against it did not prevent me from wanting to see this movie, particularly because it stars Charlize Theron.
I didn't know that this was based on any source material until after I saw the film. Mm-hmm. It's based on a graphic novel or comic book, if you will, called The Coldest City. I like that title a whole lot more than Atomic Blonde, especially because they don't even play Atomic by Blondie.
Correct.
They don't play that song. The name of the movie is Atomic Blonde.
Yeah.
One of Blondie's most famous songs, Atomic, and they don't play it.
You're right.
But anyway, it's fine. It's called The Coldest City because it's based in Berlin at the height of the Cold War.
Berlin.
Yes. This is in 1989, before the wall has come down. Most of the world is focused, of course, on East and West and the wall. And so this makes the warring government factions, it makes it easier for them to do their subterfuge and espionage because nobody's really paying attention to what these people are doing. There's a great MacGuffin in this movie, which is a list of names of double agents. Now, MacGuffin is a film term that I think Hitchcock created,
correct,
which basically means a plot device that doesn't really mean anything, but it sets wheels in motion.
And I'm going to say right up front here, before you get on with the rest of the plot, everything he's going to tell you about the plot doesn't matter to your enjoyment of this movie.
Absolutely. True. And that's why it's a great MacGuffin. Because the list of names of double agents just puts you in Berlin. That's all it does.
Yep.
And all I knew about the movie going into it was that David Leitch, who directed it, was the co-director on the first John Wick movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not usually a fan of big action movies, lots of blow-em-ups and fisticuffs and gunplay. That's probably why I haven't seen the Fast and Furious films, the last of which starred Charlize Theron, as a matter of fact.
That's correct.
But I do like the John Wick films very much. They're brutal, they're straightforward, great action choreography. And I thought, well, I guess this is just a gender-swapped John Wick. And I was pleasantly surprised that I was wrong. This is not really similar to a John Wick movie because it's not some sort of international assassins heightened reality thing. This is, I think, trying to recreate maybe the feeling of Berlin before before the wall came down.
Yep. I will also tell you that David Leitch, the director of this, before he started working as a director on movies, and he was uncredited for John Wick, but he did direct the action sequences in that, which is the entire movie.
Yes.
Before that, he was a stuntman for a couple of decades. He was Brad Pitt's double in 5 movies.
Wow.
And doubled for Jean-Claude Van Damme in 2 of his movies.
Hmm.
So he knows about stunt people and stunts and action sequences. Now, I have to ask you this about this movie, Atomic Blonde. Mm-hmm. Which is essentially fight scene after fight scene after fight scene with boring exposition in between.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with me that the device that they use in this movie of doing it in flashback as she is sitting in a room being debriefed by an MI6 British supervisor and an American supervisor, played respectively by Toby Jones and John Goodman, that whole device of her telling the story in flashback is completely unnecessary?
Yes, I don't like, I mean, this is a frame story, which means you start at the end where she's going to tell the audience the entire story by way of her superiors. I don't like that for a couple of reasons. It's not necessary, for one. Number two, you know that she survives. And before the audience rolls their eyes, well, it's Charlize Theron. I don't know. She's in some pretty precarious positions here.
Yeah.
And it would have been nice to know she wasn't just recounting what happened to her bosses. I'll also say, as far as your point about this movie being fight scene after fight scene, actually, at first, it's not. There's so much exposition about, okay, time and place, everybody, time and place, let's tell you about what's going on with Berlin, as if, is the audience, maybe I'm too old, but like, I remember all of that stuff, so I don't know why they spend so much time reminding the audience, hey, here's what it was like in Berlin, it was pretty crazy. The first couple of action scenes, the car chase, and then there's some gunplay after that, didn't really grab me, and I was a little bored with the, you know, the hints of double crossing. And I thought to myself, I don't even know if I'm really enjoying this movie besides the needle drops, besides all the great music. And then that scene happened. And you know the scene I'm talking about, the house fight scene.
Yes.
Can we talk a little bit about this?
Sure.
I don't want to descend into hyperbole here. I think it's one of the all-time greatest fight scenes.
I wrote down, best I've seen since the first Bourne Identity.
When people are ranking fight scenes, and people put, you know, the scene from the foreign film Old Boy in the hallway with the hammer, which was really influential, or they talk about the nude bathhouse fight scene in Eastern Promises with Viggo Mortensen, or the alleyway fight scene in They Live. The movie nerds out there know what I'm talking about. Those are all amazing scenes. I was blown away by this scene. The audience around me was not breathing. You could hear a pin drop.
Yep.
Those people that Charlize is fighting here were not actors. They're stuntmen that they just threw some makeup on and said, go out there and do this.
Yep.
Charlize busted her teeth. She had to have reconstructive oral surgery. She did most of her own stunt when she wasn't jumping out of buildings because of insurance reasons. But that scene won me over, and then everything after that, which is basically revealing a double cross, a triple cross, a quadruple cross, I loved all of that too. The final reveals and the final couple of moments I loved as well. The movie won me over. Sometimes, and I think when people listen to the reviews that you and I do, I think I worry that I say too much. Well, I was with the movie at first, but then it lost me. Like, because I always want to give a movie a chance. This movie was the opposite. I wasn't with it, and it won me over.
See, I was with it from the beginning, because except for that framing device. If they took that out, first of all, the movie could be 15 minutes shorter, which is usually better. And secondly, we don't need to have it told in flashback. Tell us in a linear style.
Mm-hmm.
Just present us what you're doing and get us to the important parts of this. Now, it's also important to say that in this movie, not only is Charlize Theron a kick-ass monster, better than most, certainly better than any James Bond we've seen from Daniel Craig or many others.
She you never doubt her for a moment. It's really great.
And I think it's great to see another wonderful performance by a female action star after Wonder Woman of just 4 or 6 weeks ago, whenever that came out. This is so good when it comes to the sequences where she's fighting, but also the other sequences where she's getting from point A to point B, whether in the plot or geographically, is done with such style. The way she is costumed, the her blonde hair, the way they make her look. Even the scene very early on where she is nude in a bathtub full of ice, basically covering up the pain of what she does for a living and her body covered with bruises and scratches and all that sort of stuff. That is shot in such a beautiful way. It is not exploitative in any way. And bravo to Charlize Theron for being willing to do the topless torso thing, because it works in that situation. And there's also a lesbian love scene that goes on later on. It's not graphic in any way, but it is shot in such a beautiful and stylistically perfect way.
And they don't make a big deal about it narratively, which I think is important. They show her rendezvous with a male agent many years past.
Yes.
So here you have this bisexual assassin, and it's only that information is given to you showing and not telling. And yes, I love that, because yes, they don't spend any time on that. It's just a fact of her personality and her character.
Now, anybody who would criticize us for giving away too much about this movie, everything we've just told you doesn't affect the plot outcome of the movie. It only affects the characters that you're going to see on the screen. And the action sequences, as we've said, they're the kind of fights where guys with guns have no chance against a spinning and kicking blonde woman who is going to take them all down, mm-hmm, even if every one of them is armed. It's so well done. And as I said, it's nice to see a woman doing that, because we've seen men doing that in so many other movies. And I also like the fact that the director has her using props that are right there on the set. You know what? Pick up the pot off the, mm-hmm, top of the stove, and now that becomes a key weapon in a fight.
Reminded me of watching old Jackie Chan movies, because that's what Jackie Chan always would do, is say, wait a minute, I'm going to use my coat. I'm going to use this.
This garden hose, yes, which is a great thing in one of the scenes. But it is. She has martial arts moves like some of the characters in Jackie Chan movies. It is that good. Now, I will say, overall, because of the framing device, I did have to deduct a couple of points from this. I do think it's one of the better movies of the year, but not one of the best movies of the, mm-hmm, year.
I agree.
I'm giving it a 7.5 out of 10. What do you think?
I'm right there with you. I think, based on what I know now, if I watch the film again, those things might not annoy me as much. The framing device and the slow beginning, because I know what they're moving towards. So I might actually rate it a bit higher if I watch it again. Right now, though, I would give Atomic Blonde a solid 8 out of 10.
Yeah. Okay. And James McAvoy is the co-star in this movie, mm-hmm, and he's fine. I mean,
he's playing Manic, and he does that really well. If you saw Split, you know that he can do that really well.
Yeah, he's good in that.
And the audience, of course, because you're supposed to in these movies, like when you're reading a mystery novel, you're supposed to figure out who done it. And in this movie, you will think, well, he's the bad guy, she's the bad guy, wait a minute, she's the bad guy, he's the bad guy, wait a minute, they're the bad guy. And that's half the fun, is seeing how they surprise you even after you think you have it figured out.
I don't think of this as a whodunit. I don't think of it as a detective story. I think of this as a really good secret agent / spy movie, kind of like the Bourne movies, where you're rooting for this hero who has to take on whatever task it is. And in this case, there's that MacGuffin that you, yes, mentioned of the list, and the person who put the list together, and handling all that stuff that has to be gotten out of East Berlin and into West Berlin, and will she be able to accomplish the mission? As opposed to, will she be able to find out the end of this mystery?
Oh, sure, yeah, but I mean for the audience to try to figure out who they can trust and who they can't. Something I liked more than the Bourne films is that pretty much right away, Jason Bourne was fighting against Treadstone, and that reminds me of Tom Cruise fighting against the Mission Impossible people every single film. What's nice about James Bond is he does horrible things. He kills a lot of people, but he's doing it for His Majesty's Secret Service.
For the same company that Charlize Theron's character
MI6.
Because she's British in this movie.
Yes, and I like that too, that she's not just following orders, but I mean, this is her job. This is her life. And she masks that obvious pain with a whole lot of vodka. Attention to detail, Stiliana was absolutely the biggest vodka in the world in the late 80s, and that's all she drinks.
Yep. Was she this much of a kick-ass in Mad Max Fury Road?
Very different. A lot more pain, but absolutely. I mean, she was the star of that film. It's her movie. It's not Max's film.
So is she the premier female action movie star?
I mean, after Wonder Woman, it's going to be hard to dethrone gal, you know, because everybody equates her with Wonder Woman now. But the success of Mad Max Fury Road actually gave Charlize the bargaining chips to make this movie. She wants this to be her franchise. There are two prequel books that go into McAvoy's character's backstory and hers as well before she gets to Berlin. She wants to make those movies.
Okay, so this is the beginning of a
she wants
Atomic Blonde franchise.
If it does well.
Well,
if
that's
it doesn't,
that's, then, that's my next question to you. Yeah. Will this do well this weekend?
I think so. You know, people were burnt out on Spider-Man because we've had six of those. We haven't had six Atomic Blonde. And the only movie that people are bringing up are the John Wick movies. Well, it's same director. But people love John Wick. So I do think people will go see this. And I think that Charlize has turned into a really dynamic actress. I mean, she's an Oscar winner. I don't think anybody would have foreseen that when she first burst onto the scene. And I think now this could launch her into the next level of her career.
I think it also opens up the demographic potential here. Just as Wonder Woman brought in a lot more women who would not normally go to, quote, a comic book movie, unquote, I think this will bring in a lot of women who want to see a female super spy hero on screen who can do all of those kicks and moves and all the rest of the stunts. I think it's going to be a big winner this weekend.
I hope so.
I have no idea what the expectation is.
Well, it's opening up against the Emoji Movie, so I give a tip of the hat to Atomic Blonde.
But the Emoji
Nobody's
Movie...
Nobody's going to see Emoji Movie.
Well, I was going to say, the Emoji. If the Emoji Movie draws anybody, they'll be nine and under.
True.
They'll be the ones who couldn't get in to go see Atomic Blonde.
But I'm pretty sure Emoji Movie is going to be a pretty big flop. I mean, it's not even on my kid's radar, and he's six, and this would be right up his alley. He doesn't care. I don't think he uses smartphones. He doesn't know what emojis are.
Okay. But you see, this is one of those things where I imagine that there was a Hollywood meeting where somebody came in and said, okay, what's your idea? Let's hear your pitch. Three words, the Emoji Movie. Green light, definitely, we have to
absolutely.
Do that.
Well, it's because Lego Movie came out and actually got a whole bunch of critical praise, and it surprised everybody by being a good movie. A movie that I thought was going to be a shameless cash grab, the Lego Movie, turns out to be brilliant, and so I'm sure that's how it got greenlit.
All right, I just want to make one point here. Just the fact that I said that women are going to go see this movie doesn't mean that men won't and men shouldn't. They absolutely should. Everybody will see this. I just think that having a female, having a heroine like this Charlize Theron character will draw more women to this genre than would normally go see it. But it's by no means a movie for women.
I don't think you have to convince men to see it after you said there was a lesbian sex scene and Charlize is nude. I think you've already done enough with that.
Well, so. You've seen the poster. It's just her shoulder, her bare shoulder, as she looks over and she's holding a gun in her hand. That will sell tickets by itself. If you and I had not said anything about this, that would have sold a lot of tickets. So there you go. That's our review of Atomic Blonde. More showbiz stuff coming up here on the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Ian and Dan and Tim are here with me, and Max is here this hour to talk about movies. We've already reviewed Atomic Blonde, which we both liked a lot. We didn't love it, but we both liked it a lot and thought that Charlize Theron was remarkable in the movie, especially considering she does a lot of her own stunt work, and there are some scenes in there with fights that are amongst the best we've ever seen on screen. So that's just a capsule version in case you missed the previous segment where we reviewed that movie. And then there are a couple of other things that are out on DVD this week, which Max wants to touch on, including one that I liked, but I know you didn't, called Gifted.
True. I did not like this film at all. I think it's fair to say that I hated this film, as a matter of fact. Let's start with some positives, though, that you and I can agree on. The young actress, McKenna Grace, who is, I believe, has either a Disney or Nickelodeon background. She's one of these young actors who it comes across like she's 40.
I compared her to Tatum O'Neill in Paper Moon,
absolutely.
Or Drew Barrymore in E.T., or Quinn Cummings in The Goodbye Girl.
Or Haley Joel Osment in Sixth Sense. I mean, they're these or Henry Thomas in E.T. There are these young actors who give these amazing, so she's great in the movie. The movie, though, I had a huge problem with the whole idea. It's this, it's Chris Evans, Captain America, who takes custody of his niece, and she is a math prodigy. And he decides, you know, I'm going to turn down scholarships for her because she should play on a playground like every other kid.
And she's only 7 years old.
The pressure is just too much. And I thought it had this weird anti-intellectual streak where it was trying to say that you could either either be a kid or be gifted, but you can't be both. So I didn't really care for that.
Our fellow movie reviewer, Kate Marquis, at the time, raised an important question, which is, why is it that athletically gifted kids should be immersed in intensive physical training from a young age, like gymnastics, soccer, baseball, or any other youth sport, to the detriment of their, quote, normal life, but academically gifted kids shouldn't? What's so wrong with putting a very smart girl into an environment where she's surrounded by other bright children in a rigorous curriculum that encourages the expansion of their knowledge and is designed to meet their academic needs?
Hooray for Kate!
I agree with her 100% on that. However, and there's always however in life, I really liked this movie, mostly because of this 7-year-old actress, or 10 or whatever she is, playing the 7-year-old, Mary, in the movie. Her name is McKenna Grace. She is so good, and the story that revolves around her is kind of compelling because of the adults who get involved and start fighting over that choice of whether she should be mainstreamed in a normal school or put into an academically gifted curriculum. And for anybody who has a kid who's had to make that choice themselves, I think you'll see a lot of your own decision-making reflected in the arguments that go on in this movie.
I don't know, because I wish the people who were advocating for her to go into the gifted classes or the gifted schools wouldn't have been so demonized and portrayed as villains. Because I think that, I mean, there's a grandmother here who's portrayed as a villain who might have actually, I mean, I don't want to spoil anything, but might have done some horrible things in her past. So that to me, there's no good argument here. It's just the bad guys and the good guys.
Yeah. All right. I liked it more than you did. For me, it kind of had echoes of the 1991 Jodie Foster directed movie Little Man Tate, which is about a very similar subject with Diane Wiest as a psychiatrist who wants to help out her very, very gifted son. So I liked it more than you did. So the movie's Gifted. Now you see both sides of that one. What else do you have this week?
And you're the bad guy and I'm the good guy there. So
fine.
Also, I mentioned this on...
Movies are worse if you don't have a good bad guy.
True. I mentioned this on Tuesday because I thought Dan Strauss had seen this movie. Turns out he hadn't, but on Tuesday, The Boss Baby with Alec Baldwin was released. And I know that when it was originally theatrically released, Dan was all excited because Alec Baldwin's funny and it's a baby in a suit. And it's out now. I think it's going to do pretty well on home video. It's fine for little kids. I took my 6-year-old Oscar. He laughed at it. I asked him afterwards, what was your favorite part of The Boss Baby? And he said, when the boss baby tooted. So there's your level of comedy here with The Boss Baby.
And I would love it for that.
Exactly. I think so.
Okay. I want to talk about a movie that I did not see when it first came out. I missed the screening or whatever, and my wife and I said immediately we want to see it because it's written and directed by a guy who we like, Jordan Peele from Key and Peele. We had watched that series on Comedy Central for years, and we thought both of these guys were good. We really liked Keanu, which was the movie that they made together last year.
The kitten.
Yeah. Yes, which is, by the way, showing on every premium cable channel right now, if you haven't seen it. Put that one on your DVR, Keanu. It's really funny and really clever, and a little bit violent, but let's throw that in. But the movie that he made last year, which came out early this year, and is probably going to be on a lot of reviewers' best of lists, is called Get Out, written and directed again by Jordan Peele. It stars an actor who you may not know by the name of Daniel Kaluuya. Mm-hmm. I didn't know him from anything.
Nope.
Did you?
No.
He is an African-American guy who is dating a character played by Allison Williams, Brian Williams' daughter, who was on the Lena Dunham show Girls on HBO for many years.
And she's also Peter Pan. She was the live-action Peter Pan.
Exactly. Her parents are played by Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener, two people I usually like. And I liked him in this one as well. This is the one where the African-American guy goes away for the weekend with his girlfriend to meet her parents, who are wealthy and live in, I don't know, some community with a lot of other people who are very well off and who are all white.
He says to her, have you mentioned that I'm a black guy? And she goes, no, my parents don't care about that. And he goes, I get it. I get they don't care, but maybe you should mention it before. Yeah. And she's like, no, they're not going to care.
No. By the way, she says, by the way, my father's the kind of person who would say, if Obama ran a third time, I would have voted for him. And of course, once they get there, it doesn't take 30 seconds for Bradley Whitford's character to say exactly that. And so he knows exactly what kind of white people he's dealing with there, or at least he thinks so.
He thinks so.
And then there are a couple of people who work around the house, both African-American. One is the maid slash housekeeper, and another one is the, what do you call him, the
groundskeeper.
Gardener, groundskeeper.
And even then, when he shows up, he thinks, well, this it's just a little odd, because they're African-American, and they're serving a white family, basically. Even on the surface, he's like, hmm.
Yeah.
But then it gets weirder.
But he notices that little thing at first, and then the feeling begins to nag at him as he sees their interactions with the white people a little bit more, and something seems a little wrong. Maybe they seem, well, this is an odd thing to say, but they seem a little Stepford wife.
Absolutely.
And perhaps that was an inspiration to Jordan Peele as he was making this movie. And if you don't know that reference, Google it, Stepford wife. But he notices that something is wrong here, and he doesn't know what it is. And I'm not going to tell you anything else about the plot, because I think you need to discover this movie by yourself.
That's about all I knew when I went in, and I think that's perfect.
Okay. I will say, some people are saying this is a horror movie. It absolutely is not. This movie is creepy, but it's not scary. There are things that happen in this movie that will make you go, ah, but nothing that's going to make you, ah! Choose your own sound effect as you go along through the movie and decide which one is appropriate for you. But I loved this movie. I'm giving it a 9 out of 10. It is going to be... Is it a 2017 movie? Did it come out this year?
It came out this year.
All right, it's going to be on my top 10 list.
It will also be on my top 10 list. I loved it when I first saw it. I will agree with you when I... I've seen it twice now. I watched it once at home on Blu-ray after I saw the screening. When I saw the screening, I couldn't get over the fact that it was marketed as a horror film, because I saw it as not only a darker thriller, but almost a dark comedy. It's a very funny film, even though it's not just a regular Key and Peele comedy.
You know what it fits in with? Twilight Zone and Black Mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't seen the Black Mirror series on Netflix, stream that.
When I watched Get Out again at home, I connected even more with the social commentary, and I was able to forgive that it wasn't just a straight horror film. And it absolutely holds up. It plays the audience like a fiddle. He's an incredibly accomplished director.
Yes.
This is his first movie.
Yes.
I cannot believe that he takes a lot from John Carpenter's Halloween. There's a lot of great scenes here. Just an amazing job by Jordan Peele, who's had the script for a long time. And I think it really subverts audience expectations of where it's going to go. And I just can't say enough good things.
I made a lot of money at the box office. I mean, it was a low-budget movie, and it made a ton of money. It's probably one of the biggest winners of the year,
mm-hmm.
if you compare those two numbers, money in, money out. And I think it's also going to have another tremendous life on DVD, it already is, and streaming as well. And then once you get around to award season and people start talking about it again,
you'll see it again. Yeah, exactly.
I hope that it gets nominated for a bunch of things, and I hope he gets nominated.
I imagine
too.
Original screenplay for one. And I mean, they don't like nominating first-time directors for best director, because it's old director's club. They don't like doing that, but
they did it for Kevin Costner,
and I think they should
did it for Robert Redford.
And I think they should do it for Jordan Peele, because
yes.
He does an amazing job bringing the story together.
The bottom line for him, though, is awards or not, he can now write his own ticket, can mm-hmm. he?
Yes.
I mean, when your first time out, you hit not a home run, but a grand slam like this, you can pretty much make any movie you want going forward.
He said he had three, he called them horror movie scripts, that he had three horror movie scripts ready to go, but they're all like Get Out, so don't expect a slasher movie from him. I think they're all going to be these type of dark thrillers.
Psychological
yes.
movies,
yeah.
more
What's
than
the name
anything.
Of this movie?
It's called Get Out.
Okay.
Now, it reminds me, when I first heard about the movie, it reminded me of a routine Eddie Murphy used to do years and years ago when
Amityville
he was doing stand-up.
Routine.
Yes,
yeah.
he was talking about the movie Amityville Horror, which is about this family that moves into a house and then it's haunted. And even though there are voices there, they don't take
the house
hint.
Says get out.
Right.
Yeah.
He said if that movie had been about a black family, they would have walked in and said, wow, this is such a beautiful place. We're so happy to be here. Get out. Too bad we can't stay. Which may have been where Jordan Peele got the idea for the name of this movie.
Yeah.
It's just Get Out. And it's really, really good. You had something else to mention for this week.
Ghost in the Shell is now on Blu-ray and DVD. This was a movie that was released to some controversy and calls of whitewashing, because it was based on a Japanese animated film from the mid-90s, and it stars Scarlett Johansson. And everybody said, well, she is not Japanese. Why does she star in this movie? Well, it's
right.
The complicated answer is...
they couldn't get Emma Stone.
Exactly. right. Well, no, she's Asian. See, she's got a quarter right. Asian and Aloha.
Yeah.
Now, it's a complicated answer because this has to do with synthetic bodies and android bodies, and they could put her into one that looks Caucasian. And it actually is a plot point in the movie. I don't want to spoil it, but if that kept you from seeing the film, but you like these kinds of things, special effects heavy action movies, I would recommend Ghost in the Shell. It's nothing groundbreaking because we've seen movies like The Matrix and other movies that were actually influenced by that anime, but don't let that controversy prevent you from watching what is a pretty fun film.
Okay. Finally, have we talked about the Charlie Sheen 9/11 movie? I don't think so.
I saw a small clip, and honestly, I thought it was a joke.
There's a movie that's going to come out just a couple of days before September 11th of this year, which is called 9/11, which follows fictional characters played by Charlie Sheen and Gina Gershon and Luis Guzman and some others as they attempt to get out of one of the towers of the World Trade Center on the morning of the attacks. Now, just before we started the show today, we were having an off-air discussion of something called the concept of too soon. Because I was recently watching the CNN series, A History of Comedy, in which a bunch of comedians talked about when is it too soon for a joke about something. When could you make a 9/11 joke, for instance? Well, Gilbert Gottfried made one at a Friars Club roast of Hugh Hefner a week after 9/11, and people shouted out, too soon, too soon, which then caused him to launch into the Aristocrats joke, which had had everybody falling out of their seats because he made it even more disgusting than anybody else had.
Well, and he lost the Affleck gig after the tsunami joke on Twitter.
Yeah,
right. Now, I would tell you that unless you're talking about the documentaries that came out about 9/11 a year or two afterwards, remember the one that was made by those French filmmakers who were doing a documentary about firefighters in New York, and it happened to be on the morning of 9/11, and they got footage of the first plane hitting the first tower, and then they followed those firefighters as they went into the towers? That was an absolutely remarkable documentary that got shown on CBS with no commercials, and it got a huge rating. That sort of stuff doesn't ever fall under the heading of too soon. But a fictional account of the people who were in that building, and you're turning it into the towering inferno, it's still too soon as far as I'm concerned. What do you think?
Do you think the casting has any bearing on this conversation because it's not Brad Pitt?
I would say the same thing with Brad Pitt, but it's even more objectionable because it's Charlie Sheen.
Exactly.
Because he's a 9/11 truther. He's one of these people who believes the nonsense conspiracy theories that the towers were knocked down by our own government, blah, blah, blah.
I want to say
BS.
It was back in 2005 or 2006, so not too long ago, 10 or so years ago, Robert Pattinson, he was the lead in all those Twilight movies,
yes.
Okay? He did this romance with a young actress, I forget her name, and it was called Remember Me. And the whole thing was this, oh, we have a doomed romance and everything. The final scenes of the movie, he goes into work or goes to visit a friend or something in the Twin Towers. And that's how the movie ends, is they can't be together because he dies in the attacks of 9/11. How is that okay?
Now, I have to add something here. I was talking on this show just a few weeks ago, having been to New York and taking my wife and daughter and mother to go see a Broadway musical called Come From Away, which is a feel-good musical about 9/11. It doesn't take place in New York. It takes place in Gander, Newfoundland, Canada, and it's about the people in that town and how they dealt with this influx of planes that was forced to land there when U.S. airspace was closed on 9/11. And it is a really heartfelt, wonderful musical that has a few light moments in it, but also some great songs and some great performances. That sort of thing is appropriate. Doing the Towering Inferno with this 9/11 backdrop, which is essentially what this is, taking us back to Irwin Allen disaster movies, putting all these people in an elevator in the Twin Towers, and they communicate with Whoopi Goldberg through the phone. She's like an administrator for some rescue organization, whatever it is. It's just horrific to think about why somebody in Hollywood would green light that.
And if they die, then the movie is sort of, I mean, why are you making the movie? If they survive, it's even more insulting. If these fictional characters make it out alive,
correct,
are you supposed to root for them? I mean,
Yeah. Ridiculous. That's the showbiz stuff for this week on the Big 550 KTRS.